Great. So our next excellent presentation is from Mark Stanger. He's going to speak about Toward a Social Ecology of Neisseria Gonorrhea, Association of Incidence in Females with Neighborhood Characteristics in Five Geographically Disparate States from 2006 to 2008.
That's also a very long title, and thank you, Patty, for that introduction.
And
I love the use of the word adjective, or the adjective excellent, before I've even started. So I will say that I really appreciate being contexted in this series of talks. We've certainly seen from previous talks that place matters, and our study also looks at place. Well, you've actually heard some of the background here today, but there's a growing body of literature that's beginning to look at aerial-based measures or what we want to call the social determinants of health at geographic areas, linking that with all sorts of negative health outcomes, whether that be chronic diseases, infectious diseases, or also other social undesirable things such as crime rates and other things. So this is adding to that body of literature, but what's different here is most of the previous studies have really looked at small areas within a single jurisdiction. There are a few national studies that have looked across larger areas, and this is one of the constraints of public health data, is we don't necessarily have the aerial-based designation for all of our cases. So there are a few studies that look at the county level, look at the state level across the entire nation. And what we looked at was we looked at census tract level information across five states. Our objective was to take advantage of a unique data system we have at CDC called the STD Surveillance Network, which gives us geocoded information for gonorrhea cases at the population level in a number of states. And in this case, we're using five states from our first cycle of the STD Surveillance Network. And our objectives were to look at the relationship between gonorrhea incidence among women and social and demographic characteristics at the census tract level. We looked at incidence among women because male incidence in a number of our sites included a significant portion, up to 40% of males were MSM. We don't have denominators for MSM, which is an entirely different story that needs to be addressed in our health information networks. And MSM may indeed have very different social determinants. There's some literature beginning to suggest that the same social determinants that attend for health outcomes among heterosexuals are not the same for MSM. And we use census tracts from five non-contiguous SUN sites in our study. These are the areas that we're collaborating in the first cycle of SUN, and you can see there is a great deal of geographic dispersion among those sites. And when we included census tract information, we actually limited that to counties within those sites where they were doing population-level surveillance on a random sample of cases that were reported with gonorrhea. But our data actually include all reported gonorrhea in the counties that are identified as red dots on this. Our study data included 11 counties or independent health districts and over 1,500 census tracts. And the total morbidity across the study period was about 8,700 cases of gonorrhea among females being reported. The hypothesis that we wanted to test, and this was fairly general and certainly suggested to us by studies elsewhere, was that poverty predicts female gonorrhea rates. At a small area, geographic area, that we actually are choosing to call neighborhood in our study because it's the best sort of geographic level to reflect neighborhood characteristics other than block group, and the numbers got very small when we looked at census blocks and block groups. We selected household poverty rather than individual income or some of the other measures such as median household income that could have been used because we really thought that this might reflect some ecologic characteristics other than just characteristics of individuals. So the primary measure that we were looking at was the proportion of households in each of the census tracts with annual incomes less than 150% of the federal poverty level, which in 2007, that was only about 31,000 for a household of four. So what we didn't do is we didn't take 100% of federal poverty. We didn't look at higher, but what we wanted to reflect was a group that potentially has some resources but are still resource constrained. What we did was we calculated the three-year average incidence rates among women for all of the census tracts in our study type. We tested the overall effects of a number of SES measures, and I'll cover what some of the additional measures were. over and above household property. And we used a multi-level mixed effects model to determine independent effects in the magnitude and the direction of any of the associations with our covariates. Some of the other factors we looked at proportion of the housing units that were renter-occupied versus owner-occupied, again, thinking this might help to reflect some neighborhood characteristics. The proportion of the adult population completing high school, so educational attainment was one of the covariates we were interested in. Population density, and at the census tract level in terms of persons per square mile. We also looked at, because there has been some suggestion in the literature, that the more dense neighborhoods, dense sexual networks, et cetera, so we wanted to assess that as well. We also looked at the proportion of the female population that were non-white at the census tract level. We didn't break that down any further than that, really only wanting a binary variable at this point in time to look at that. We also looked at something that has been of great concern lately, which is the dispersion of income or the income inequality at the geographic level. Well, in our multivariate modeling, we looked at all of those factors as covariates at the census tract level. And first, we assessed each one of those for a fit in an unconditional model, which means we weren't throwing them all together to compete equally for the variance, just looking at them one at a time. And only the factors that were significant in our uncontrolled models were included in our final models. And then we also controlled for clustering at the county or health district level using a hierarchical technique. Well, this is the result of an unconditional model just looking at the increasing proportion of households less than 150% of the federal poverty level along the x-axis and along the y-axis increasing GC rates. And that dispersion cloud already suggests some of the association that we're going to find, that with increasing proportion of households below 150% of the federal poverty level, we did indeed see an increase. So the proportion of households below 150% FPL predicts higher GC rates among women at the census tract level. Well, we did have some clustering at the county level, that the relationship between census tracts was likely to be that they were more similar within counties than they were across counties. So that was our first hierarchical level. As you can see, though, the magnitude and the direction of the association was relatively consistent across all of the counties, the 11 counties in our study. Well, three factors remain significant in our final model. Certainly the proportion of households less than 150% of the federal poverty level, the proportion of the female population that was represented by women of color at the census tract level was also still significant, and the proportion of households in rental housing versus owner-occupied remained significant, though not as robust in our overall model. We think from our model diagnostics that this explains about 50% of the variation in rates. What was interesting and somewhat surprising to us were the things that dropped out of the model when we put them all together, that income inequality wasn't significant in this model. Neither was educational attainment. Well, the interpretation here was a little complex because we used log-transformed rates and we used a grand mean-centered measure for the proportion of households below 150% of the federal poverty level. But when we back-calculate that, in our models, we found that a 10% increase in households below 150% of federal poverty was associated with an observed increase of about 10.8 female cases per 100,000. Which may not sound a lot, but in the aggregate, that is a significant increase in rates. We also found, similarly, for the proportion of the female population that was non-white, as that increased by 10%, we also observed about a 10.5 case increase per 100,000. The effect of the proportion of housing units that were renter versus owner-occupied was less robust, and that predicted about an 8 per 100,000 increase, independently, that these factors independently predicted those increases in gonorrhea rates. And that's kind of a significant finding. We looked at interaction effects. We also looked at multicollinearity and confounding and found that these are independently associated. Well, why is this important? Well, it raises some important questions for us. Is access to medical care for women in areas where there's a greater proportion of households below federal poverty adequate? health insurance issues. And we've heard some of that in our plenary this morning. So these are questions that we really need to explore better and look at how that relationship is significant. And I think it also suggests to us a programmatic strategy that we may want to take is that we should include geographic targeting. And I think some of our previous speakers have also alluded to that, venue-based and geographic targeting, to assure that we're really reaching the folks at highest risk. And it also suggests to me, as all of the social determinants work does, is that categorically STD programs cannot solve poverty. And I don't think it's within our purview to do that. We certainly can't affect the proportion of people living in rental versus owner-occupied. But what we can do is we can partner with the agencies that attempt to address some of those other social determinant issues. Well, there's some real limitations to this kind of work. And certainly in the STD surveillance network, our sites are not chosen to be representative of the entire United States. And there's also an issue in any kind of ecologic analysis that the unit of measure geographically that you choose may distort your data or influence your findings. And, you know, census tracts may not truly reflect neighborhoods in many areas. Certainly anyone who's done that work knows this, but it might be one of the best proxies we have. And another limitation is that these data were collected in the middle of the 2000s. It may not represent what has happened since 2008. And it's of great interest to us to see, has the economic situation nationally changed either the robustness or the associations that we find at small geographic levels. So our next steps on this kind of analysis is to look at a much larger sample. Our current cycle of the STD surveillance network includes 11 states. We have about 6,000 census tracts now that we could include in that. And also the American Community Survey, which is the replacement for the census long form that went away after the 2000 census, is now maturing. So we have much better aerial-based measures that we can do this work with. We also have interesting things happening with healthcare transformation that might be very interesting for us to have some baseline measures to explore. And, you know, we're very curious, too, is screening adequate? And certainly as we transform many of the infrastructures for screening people for STDs, we're very concerned with this. Do we have provider deserts? I've always loved the literature around food deserts. Do we have provider and healthcare deserts? And that's something we can look at in the second cycle of the STD surveillance network, where we may actually be able to geocode some providers, look at where providers are located and how that relates to rates of disease. Well, certainly none of this work would be possible without the collaboration of our funded SUN sites and the principal investigators who contributed very meaningfully to the work we've done. And I'd like to recognize them at those point in time and ask if there are any questions. And, gee, I didn't go too far.
You're great.
Thank you.
You're good.
Joan. Thank you, Dr. Chow. Those are both very good questions, and both relate to incarceration. And in the STD surveillance network or any other data system, do we have information on incarceration? And then the second question was, we have some data that indicates what the incarceration rates are. And I think this is available by race and ethnicity at small geographic areas, and that might be an interesting covariate to include in models like this. I agree with both. And I will tell you that we, in this particular study, we were looking at all cases reported at the census tract level, so we really didn't have the benefit of enhanced behavioral information for all of those cases. Although in our current STD surveillance network, we do a random sample of GC cases, so we may be able to develop at some level of geographic specificity below the county level estimates of recent incarceration among index cases. So, yes, thank you.
Great. I have one question. So how were the sites chosen? I just noticeably missing is the Delta, Deep South, where the highest rates are, and some other areas.
That is a very good question. And the sites for the first cycle of SUN and indeed for the second cycle of the STD surveillance network were chosen through open competition, all health departments and independently funded cities. That received the comprehensive STD prevention grants were eligible to apply. So in some ways, this is a convenient sample of sites, and it's a convenient sample of sites that were that had sufficient infrastructure to collect the kinds of information we want it to do for Sentinel surveillance. So it's not a random sample of cases or of jurisdictions, which would be prohibitively difficult to do and to analyze.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
Thank you so much.
Oh, we have one last question.
She hasn't kicked me off yet.
I'm Stephanie Starris from University of Chicago. How did you choose which variables of the census to use?
What a fabulous question. Arbitrarily. No, not completely arbitrarily, but sometimes this is a convenience to choose what your covariates are. What data do you have available to us? To you, and in our case, we had a limited amount of information from the census long form, and we actually had to use some market data, market segmentation data that was available to us to determine the at the correct time frame, because the ACS data were not available to us yet at that point in time. It's also what are you interested in, and we were very interested in household characteristics as better reflective perhaps of neighborhood characteristics than individual level or aggregate population level characteristics such as income of individuals. So while there was some thought that went into the choice of these covariates, it's often arbitrary and dependent on what you have available.
Thank you so much.